Welcome to the Bengals Wire Podcast. I'm your host, Cameron Zargar. In this episode, we're going to talk about the Bengals' bold move to improve their offensive line, and along with declining Adam Jones' option, if it's a sign that the Bengals are going to continue to improve the roster in days to come. Today, we're going to be talking about something we don't normally get to talk about, and that's the Bengals trading for a quality player. The Bengals made a move for Cordy Glenn. In return, the Bills get to move from number 21 up to number 12, and they hand the Bengals over their fifth round pick, and the Bengals pick up the Bills' sixth round pick. But the bigger story for the Bengals is how this changes the dynamic of their offensive line, which was the biggest weakness last year. The Bengals, by adding Glenn, solidify the most important spot for a team with a right-handed quarterback, at least traditionally, left tackle. And this allows them to, you know, move on from making that a priority in the draft. And it means they can go after a center in the first round, which could set off a kind of ripple effect where Russell Bodine somehow is no longer in Cincinnati. Now I'm getting ahead of myself. So before we get to those topics, I want to introduce our guest for today, someone that any real Bengals fan already knows, and that's Joe Goodberry. Currently a writer for The Athletic, and before that he wrote for Cincy Jungle for a few years, for the Bleacher Report, he did the NFL 1000 there, and for Bengals Wire. But most of you probably know Joe from his strong and analytical presence on Twitter. Joe, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Cameron.
So I want to start with the positives. How does Glenn, now we're not going to talk about his injuries yet, but just how does Glenn, his physical talent, how does he improve the offensive line immediately?
Well, obviously, last year, putting in Cedric Oboihe at left tackle was as bad as you could have expected, I guess. We saw Oboihe at right tackle in the previous year, 2016, and it was obviously a bad start to a first-round pick's career, and from there, they moved him to the left side. Claimed it would be his natural position. Anyone who watched him knew that wouldn't probably make a difference in his game at all, and it really didn't. And it affected the game planning. It affected how the Bengals operated, the type of pass plays they called. And even though they're a quick passing offense, they, you know, looked scared to throw it. And I think Andy Dalton even it affected his play, even when, oh boy, he was having okay or decent games. So from there, you go to a guy in Cordy Glenn who's been a very good starting left tackle for the Bills, and I mean, in 2016, you mentioned the Bleacher Report's NFL 1000. In 2016, Glenn's real last time he's played the majority of a season, that year is about 650 snaps, so not even a full year that year. But I believe he was ranked number 6 at left tackle, and Andrew Whitworth was 11th that year. So if you think he was graded on some metric better than Andrew Whitworth was, and we know how good Whitworth was for the Bengals, so you're getting that kind of guy when healthy. Long arms, strong hands. Not the most athletic guy, but big at 345 pounds, 6'6", long wingspan, really makes it hard to get around. He's a good pass protector because of his hands and because of that weight. He can really anchor and reset. The exact opposite of Oboihe, who really struggled with the bull rush and the power guys and the late hands and the bad hand work. A lot of things that made him bad are what make Cordy Glenn good at the top of his game. So it's going from a bottom end guy who probably should not be starting for most teams in Oboihe to, well, when healthy, a guy that would start for most teams in the NFL.
Yeah, well, we're staying positive here, you know, because this trade kind of changes how we think about the Bengals, because we all don't think of them as making bold moves, especially when it comes to other teams' players. You know, you said he graded better than Whitworth his last healthy season. Maybe the Bengals were planning something like this all along, and they were actually trying to be more competitive than we initially gave them credit for. That was a joke, by the way. But, yeah. So going back to the 2016 season, Pro Football Focus. Now, I'm using them. I'm sure you have other grading systems that you prefer.
Oh, I like BFF.
Okay. Well, according to Pro Football Focus, other than his rookie year, which was still solid, and last year when he only played in 6 games, he's never fallen below 82.3 as an overall grade. And another thing I like is that he's been very balanced, solid run blocking and pass blocking, both of them around 80 every year that he was healthy after his rookie year. So not only, as you said, does this take pressure off Dalton, and that's a bigger factor for Cincinnati than it is for some other NFL teams because of Dalton's limitations as a creative passer, as someone who can, you know, make things happen in the pocket. Not only is that huge in terms of letting Dalton kind of settle down and pick apart a defense the way he can, but also because the Bengals had such a promising running back who really hasn't gotten to show his stuff yet because of the major issues on the offensive line. So this could take the Bengals from having, you know, a historically bad offense from a franchise perspective to having a pretty solid one, wouldn't you say so?
Oh, for sure. Look at when they had their best offenses, you know, under Marvin Lewis. So go back, we can have a full 15-year stretch to look. 05 and 2015, they weren't just great offenses. He had very good offensive lines on that team. So, yeah, it definitely has a correlation to passing success and running success. Obviously, when you have a bottom five unit, it's going to drag down the entire offense, and it did last year. In many ways, it neutralized a lot of talent that I would say this team lacks a lot of playmakers on offense, especially last year when Eifert goes down, when John Ross is a no-show for the entire year. They really were hurting for someone to really rely on to you know, make it so that the defense has to adjust to them and not solely exploit the offensive line. Bengals were unable to do that. And in return, the O-line had to be good in order to have average playmakers step up and make plays. And we saw it couldn't do it. And it couldn't do it consistently. So, yes, the combination was bad last year. I like the idea of them, even if they're not going to get back to those 05 and 2015 offensive lines, because I think this is probably a two-year rebuild. I think getting a veteran that's good, and if healthy, Cordy Glenn jump starts this rebuild very quickly on the offensive line, because you've now solidified the most or maybe second most offensive line position next to center. So now you can go ahead and say, all right, we got a good left tackle, we have a good left guard. If we draft a center, maybe in the first round, maybe in the second, maybe in the third, I really love this draft class this year. I think you can get a starting center in the fourth round if that's like a Mason Cole from Michigan. And if you do that, your left side is good. And it goes from being a weakness, you know, on the entire unit to at least we have a strength. Whether that's the interior guys, if they were going to sign a right guard and draft a center, this is before Glenn was traded for, you know, or you want to say we're going to get two tackles and at least you have one good unit within a unit that's sustainable. And if they draft a center and upgrade from Bodine, you have your left tackle, left guard, and center figured out. And from there, you work off that and you figure out how to run an offense with at least one half your line that's up to par and maybe even very good. So, yes, getting Glenn gives them a jump start to really fix this thing.
Yeah, and on the right side, I mean, you have Bobby Hart, right? I mean, you can just move him to right tackle, problem solved.
And that's it. And then their championship.
Yeah, no, I mean, so the Bobby Hart signing and the Chris Baker signing, I don't want to get too far off topic yet, but those were very traditional Bengals signings. This trade was not. In a way, you know, it's like we said, the Bengals are giving a guy, you know, is it $11 million next year, I think, he's gonna get from the Bengals?
11.25.
Which is, you don't hear about that. The Bengals giving so much money to a guy who never played for them.
You know what the key is here? Almost all the guaranteed money is already paid for.
Exactly.
I say this a lot for Bengals fans. We look at cap space. We look at cap hits. It's all about the guaranteed money for the Bengals. And we're here. The guaranteed money was already paid for. And if you look at the structure of Cordy Glenn's contract over the next 3 years, 3 years remaining, 11.25, 9.25, 9.5 for cap hits. Very manageable, under what they would have paid for Andrew Whitworth, clearly under, for what he got on the open market. So for them, the contract was perfect. It was one of those things when Cordy Glenn was rumored to be available, you looked at the contract, you looked at his style of play, his talent, and you go, this is perfect for the Bengals. This is a no-brainer, but you never expect it to happen because it's the Cincinnati Bengals. But I just looking at it, you were like, this should happen yesterday. And turns out it happened.
Yeah, and just one more thing, exactly. I wanted to say about how the way the contract structured is makes it more of a Bengals move. And just one other detail, which is that the next 2 years are team options. Yeah. So that gives Mike Brown a little bit less you know, stress about, you know, even though the Bengals rarely cut guys with team options, or I should say fail to exercise the options. It gives him a little more peace of mind, especially because the injuries, which brings us to the negative, the only negative about this move, which is that Glenn had his only injured season last year, and he only played in about 6 games. And I'm not exactly sure about the nature of the injury. You probably know more about that. But he did have to have an operation on his foot. What can you tell me, Joe, about his injury, whether his style of play will make it, you know, probable that the injury will be recurring? And also just about the history of guys with his size and his style of play and, you know, let's say, overcoming these injuries over the long term.
Yeah, I went back and was just reading injury reports today to see how long it lingered and, you know, how long it affected him. It seemed like it was, I mean, we're over a calendar year from the end of last year to the off-season surgery and then sitting out of OTAs and a lot of camp where the Bills weren't sure when he's going to be back, when he's going to play. They drafted Deion Dawkins in the second round. Weren't sure if Dawkins was going to play guard or right tackle. He ended up playing all the snaps at left tackle as needed, as Glenn was out. Glenn only ended up playing 275 snaps all year. They thought he was ready to come back. I read injury reports. It was first left, then right, and then right, and then left. It kept coming back. I think both feet at one point were injured. He received a shot from the famous Dr. James Andrews, who works on every NFL player, it seems like. And that got him onto the field, at least some. And he didn't look the same. Obviously, when your feet are hurting as a tackle, that's going to be an issue. I think when you're 350 pounds, it's an even bigger issue. It's not uncommon for these big offensive linemen to have back, knee, ankle, feet injuries. And it's because of so much weight, so much pressure and force coming down on them every time they move. I look at Andre Smith as a great example, and they're built similarly. I think Glenn's got a few inches on him, but still, the long arm guys that are kind of top heavy. Smith dealt with foot injuries, and he broke his foot instantly coming to the Bengals, and they ended up putting plate and screws in it to keep it from happening again after he re-injured it. Similar to Glenn, I don't know if he had the same deal where he had to have it completely re-bolstered with a plate, but foot injuries for big offensive linemen are nothing to really, you know, just brush off, because it can linger. And it looks like for Glenn, it has lingered. He's only played, you know, 900 snaps in the last 2 years, and that's not enough. The Bengals have had injured guys that they're trying to depend on, and if they're not there for them, we've seen how it's taken a toll on their offense, and they haven't been able to rebound. So if Glenn's that kind of guy, they may be lucky to have a Fisher and a Boye as a backup that have some starting experience. A boy, he can be a plug guy if you need him for a game or two. But really, this trade is made in an effort to get a good starting left tackle, and that's what Glenn is. So he's got to be healthy, and his contract pretty much demands it at $9 to $11 million over the next 3 years.
Yeah. Well, you're forgetting about Bobby Hart again, but that's okay. I'll let it slide. So that was a joke again, Joe. I just thought the Bobby Hart signing was kind of funny. It's like, you know, Giants fans were like, what are they thinking?
You know what, though? I looked back and I started looking at a bunch of January and February signings from the Bengals over the past few years. And I don't have the list in front of me right now. But guys like Ben A. Benwickery, they signed last year and were kind of like, all right, you know, this guy's been cut. He got torched for 300 yards by Julio Jones. And you know what? He ended up having a good camp in preseason, and they flipped him for a 6th-round pick. So, you know, you take these guys that are young, that have had starting experience and maybe a little bit of upside, and maybe they don't make the roster, but maybe someone else can use a swing tackle, and you end up trading them in the same way Ben Abenwickery. There was one other guy, too, that I can't remember now that I'm thinking about it, but that ended up making the roster and contributing a little bit as a January signing at the end of the year.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good way to look at it. But anyways, this trade has a lot of Bengals fans really getting ahead of themselves, thinking that this means we're going to replace Russell Bodine. And, you know, I saw an article by James Rapine saying now the Bengals should, you know, go after Cameron Fleming or Chris Hubbard, or maybe trade for Juwan James from the Dolphins, you know, solidify the right tackle position. I don't know if I don't know if they're going to go that far and really just take care of all their off-season needs. And I think they still like Fisher. I mean, I think if he's, you know, his heart problem is behind him, I think they still see him as being solid. I think Obey was so bad, they just, you know, couldn't ignore it anymore. But I think Fisher might get another chance to start. But I
like him the most. If they, let's say they have a three-way battle between, okay, let's use your guy too. Four-way battle between Oboihe, Fisher, Hart, and let's say they bring back an Andre Smith at a, you know, $2.5-3 million deal for 1 year, which seems reasonable for what how the Bengals operate. Say you have an open battle for that right tackle spot between them. I like Fisher to come out of that if he's healthy and can practice and play at full strength. I still think he was the best prospect out of him and Oboihe, and I think what he's flashed and shown, his upside, he can be a quality starter. So I'm kind of rooting for him because that would be a nice bonus. But in typical Bengals fashion, it would be in his fourth year, so you would have to sign him or extend him right after he has his first good year.
Yeah, but, you know, going back to Bodine, you know, the good thing about the Glenn trade is not only do we improve our line, but it might mean his cap hit might mean that the Bengals, you know, they always like to keep a big cushion in terms of cap space.
Oh yeah.
So now, you know, let's say, I mean, realistically, you don't pay Bodine more than what, $4.5-5 million a year. I don't even think five. But even that for the Bengals can seem like a lot of money. The other factor is going from 12 to 21, you go from, you know, picking so high where a center doesn't look as good. It's not as good in terms of PR. It might be the right move for your roster, but generally it's like, okay, if there are tackles available and we have problems on the line, let's address the tackle, even though we like the center prospect better. That's just the way it works in terms of, you know, in terms of getting the best player available. But now at 21, right, a center, that starts to make sense.
Oh, yeah. And I wrote about this at The Athletic last week, because I'm watching these offensive line prospects getting ready to, you know, for the 12th pick, making sure I've got my favorites or the guys I don't like for that spot. And the more I watch, the more I'm going, these tackles aren't worth the 12th pick, whether that's Mike McGlinchey, Connor Williams. Some people had Orlando Brown in there, but I think he flunked himself out of that at the combine. So you watch and you go, yeah, I'm not too comfortable. You know, you're sitting right on the edge of a blue chip pick. I would say top 10 guys, you're right at 12. You would hope one of those guys follow you. If not, you're going to take the best offensive lineman, especially at tackle, because you want to marry value, picking number 12, with talent. So you're watching it and you're like, yeah, I'm not sure these tackles are worth this pick. And you start watching the guards and the centers. And I got to Isaiah Wynn, who is a tackle from Georgia. Very similar to Cordy Glenn, I guess, but tackle from Georgia. And he's going to move into guard more than likely because he's 6'2". And I'm watching him, and he's fantastic. And I say, he's the second best offensive lineman behind Notre Dame's Quentin Nelson, hands down. He's better than all these tackles. And you get to the other guards, Will Hernandez from UTEP. If it wasn't for Nelson, Wynn and Hernandez will be talked about probably a lot more. Like, these guys are stud guards, man. These are guys that are top 20 picks, top 25 picks. They're DeCastro and Kevin Zeitler. So looking at it, I'm like, okay, so we got three guards better than any of these tackles. You get to the centers, and I think James Daniels out of Iowa is the best center, just because I think he's more rare than what Billy Price is in terms of athleticism, balance, and technique. I think he's ready to go now. He changes what you can do on offense more than Price does because of that athleticism. But I do like Price, too, because I think he's a plug-and-play starter at guard or center. So you come away, you say, I don't think these tackles are any of them. Even if you say Mike McGlinchey's the best one or Connor Williams is the best tackle, they're not even top five offensive linemen in this draft. You would love to be able to move back and take, you know, feel free of picking a guy just based on value. At 12, you have to consider value, I think, if you're taking an offensive lineman, because guards and centers don't normally go that high. Just like you said, you move back to 21, it makes perfect sense. Now you're free to not just draft based on value, but if somebody drops out of the top 15, you're open to it. And again, now you've opened the door and added more prospects to this list, the guards and the centers. An Isaiah Wynn, a Will Hernandez, James Daniels. If Price is healthy, I don't know if he goes top 25, but you know, he's at least in discussion at that point. And from there, too, I felt like when you're picking 12, it was right in that second tier of the first round, right? And maybe 11, 10, 11, 12 is right when the second tier of players start. The Bengals were going to have to pick right at the top of that second group. Now they're at the bottom of that second group. They can allow value to come to them. And I'm always in favor of maximizing the value there. And for me, I think it lines up perfectly if they still want to go offensive line. And if they don't, that's fine. I think where the defensive tackles are, Vita Vea, I think he's way more valuable at 21 than he is at 12. If you want to go Daron Payne, or maybe you're looking at linebackers, I'm not sure that Roquan Smith or Tremaine Edmonds are there, but maybe a Rashawn Evans, maybe a Leighton Vander Esch, you're taking that next group. But I think the value makes more sense once you move back for the players the Bengals probably still wanted at 12. Now you're just maximizing value.
On Cincinnati.com, Paul Denner Jr., he listed some of the recent centers drafted in the first round, or the most recent centers. And four of the six made the Pro Bowl. Three of the six made multiple Pro Bowls. But, you know, at the same time, none of them have been drafted higher than the top 18. But some of them were guys like, you know, Eric Wood, Alex Mack, Marquise Pouncey, Travis Frederick,
yeah,
and Ryan Kelly. So,
good list.
Yeah, it's a good list, and it seems like the perfect place to draft a center. We can't think on the Bengals' behalf, but as much as they send out these kind of messages of, you know, we need Bodine back and this and that, I don't know. I mean, I think they got to – I don't know how much they believe in Frank Pollock's ability, but if they're thinking of bringing Bodine back as a guard, you know, maybe that's different. But as a center, I don't know what they saw in him.
I said the same. If you're bringing Bodine back, and it depends on the structure of the deal, it depends on the commitment. Obviously, that's always the case with signing a guy or extending. But if Bodine doesn't have a huge commitment, even if it's a 2 or 3 year deal, and we're only talking about maybe $4 million guaranteed, something maybe a year and a half, and all that money's gone, and you can move from him. But also, if you re-sign him or keep him under the idea that it is a competition for center, because as soon as he was drafted, it never felt like they made him compete for that starting job. He walked in as the starting center. Paul Alexander, the former offensive line coach, defended him at every turn, even despite poor play for much of the 4 years he did start. And they never really challenged him. They never really brought anyone else in. Never really, you know.
Well, he won the bench press battle.
Yes,
right.
I mean, that was it.
Yeah.
Once he did that, he was a starter for life in the Bengals. And,
yeah,
you know, so that's key. And even though they draft a guy like a Christian Westerman, they never tried him at center. They said, Jake Fisher can play all five positions, but they never actually try him at center. And then they drafted J.J. Dealman, and they cut him in camp. So, you know, things like that, it makes you wonder if they bring him back and say, all right, it's an open competition. We've added a third-round pick. Let's say Frank Ragnow from Arkansas. Who I think they would really like and probably be who they thought Russell Bodine was when they were drafting him. But that's besides the point. The point is bringing back Bodine and saying, okay, if you're not the best center, maybe you'll be our right guard. The right guard competition right now, before they sign anyone or draft anyone, in that scenario, could be a competition between Russell Bodine, Trey Hopkins, Alex Redmond, and Christian Westerman. And I like the idea of four guys that have some starting experience with Hopkins and Bodine, and some upside guys. I thought that flashed last year in Westerman and Redmond, competing for one job, and let the best man win. And I can get behind bringing back a guy who has really started for 4 years for you, and to say, we don't know where you're playing, but we're open to you winning a job if you're the best man. If not, you're a really good backup at all three interior positions, and that's worth $4 million a year for, you know, if you're not paying anyone else really premium money besides Cordy Glenn. I can stomach that. I can't stomach the idea of them committing to Bodine, paying him a little bit too much, and never challenge him at the center position. And I can see that scenario playing out, and I think that's the scary scenario.
Yeah, I mean, this move for Cordy Glenn surprised me in so many ways that, you know, I mean, this is what the Bengals do to you. Every year, they get you hopeful. You're like, no, there's something different about the franchise this year. It seems like every year that happens. Maybe it's just NFL fans in general, you know, fans of bad teams, but
that's what the offseason and the draft is for.
Yeah.
That's why people love it. That's why, like, your favorite draft analyst probably roots for the Cleveland Browns or something like that, because that's all they have.
That's all they do.
It's
so different from the NBA or even baseball. I mean, like, it's very clear, you know, where a franchise falls at the beginning of each NBA season. You know what I mean? I mean, rarely do you have a team like, you know, this year, let's say the Timberwolves. We're not a playoff team now. They're the playoff team. There's a couple, you know, every year. But in general, it's like pretty clear what a team's, you know, ability. But the NFL, I mean, all the time you have, you know, non-playoff teams make it, you know, get a first round bye the next year. You know, it was like the Rams last year. There's a couple of teams.
As soon as you can get stability at quarterback, and the Bengals have had that, whether or not you believe Andy Dalton is an elite guy or a franchise guy, top 10, whatever qualifier you want to use. If you have the stability at quarterback, you should be able to compete for a playoff spot in a year. And I think that is the fun. And that's part of why I can always be sucked right back in. They can lose spectacularly in the playoffs. They can lose free agents. They can fail miserably and then retain Marvin Lewis. But then one little move and get Cordy Glenn, and they totally redeem themselves, and I'm back in it.
That's it. Yeah.
One move away.
But it's the way they did it, too, that makes me kind of think, you know, the whole talk. Because remember, when Marvin Lewis came back the first time, he said he's going to have more control. And he did. And things changed drastically. I mean, they started drafting better. They just, right? The team was very different the first time he threatened to leave and came back. This time, he said he's going to have more control of the coaching staff, I think. And in free agency, he said he might want to change
personnel decisions also.
Yeah. And we saw something that was so different. And it's not just about the cap hit that they took on that surprised me. First of all, it's not just that they got a starting player back in a trade. I can't remember the last time they did that. So I remember the last big trade, which was, trading away Carson Palmer for draft picks. Generally, we're trading away our players and getting draft picks back. But I can't remember the last time that we traded for a quality, like a guy that would start on just about every team of the league, or at least half the teams of the league even. That's the first part. And then there's the cap hit, which was just a shocker. Like, they traded a guy not on a rookie contract. That's a big deal too. And then the third part is they value their draft picks so much. And they had a pretty high draft pick, the second highest draft pick in the Dalton era. And they agreed to move back, which is something that I think
they're much more comfortable picking 21, obviously. They've done it how many times in the Dalton era?
Yeah, and they have not only that, but I can't remember too many top picks from the Bengals that worked out. I mean, I still think John Ross has ability. I'm hoping it works out. But if you look at their top 10, okay, so I remember the 90s. I'm sure you do too. I remember the early. I remember Kajana Carter. I remember David Klingler. I remember these guys. Big Daddy Wilkinson. So I'm always nervous when the Bengals are picking high, because I know it's a totally different franchise now in terms of Marvin Lewis involvement and Duke Tobin and all that. But still, something about the Bengals and picking really high, I feel like it's going to be a disaster. So I'm more comfortable picking 21 than 12. But anyways, the nature of that move was so radical. It was such a departure from what we know about the Bengals that it does have me thinking, maybe this Bodine talk, maybe this is just PR, and they are going to improve the center position. And then, you know, maybe they will find a right tackle. Maybe they, you know, Lewis has 2 years now. Maybe he is going to throw that Hail Mary. And, you know, in terms of personnel, he's still going to, you know, try to run out the clock the last 2 minutes of each half and all that. But
yeah.
But in terms of in terms of personnel decisions, maybe he's going to be a little more bold, or he's going to be able to convey his ideas to Brown a little bit more.
Who knows? That is the hope, I think, of every fan. Everyone wanted Marvin gone, I believe, unless you know him in real life and as a personal friend of yours. But I'd say 99% of Bengals fans were like, "Let's do it. I'm ready to re-roll the dice. Yeah, we might end up with a worse coach. Yeah, we may lose all power that Mike Brown has maybe given up during the Marvin Lewis era. It's worth it. I'm ready to roll the dice again." But if he's returning, and as you find out he's returning, you say, well, what did he get out of it? Because you said, we've done this two times already, I think. It feels like. What did he get? Did he get access? Did he get upgraded facilities? Did they get more scouts? Can they spend more money? Are they open to bringing in outside guys more often? We never get a clear answer on that. You kind of read between the lines. I still believe the Bengals are still the Bengals in terms of spending money. And I think, again, guaranteed money is the breadcrumb trail that you should follow with how the Bengals operate, who they can sign, who you can even... You'll see fans, well, the Bengals need to sign Andrew Norwell. Yeah, he's going to get $35 million guaranteed. There's no chance they get him. That's the reason they didn't sign Kevin Zeitler. They knew they had no chance to sign Kevin Zeitler. He gets 30.5 million guaranteed by the Browns. No chance. The highest guy guaranteed on the roster is AJ Green at $26 million. I think after that is Atkins at $18 million. I think it's Dalton at $16 million. Dunlap at $14 million. It's all in that range. It's all low numbers for guaranteed money. And that's going to take you out of the free agent market. Whether you like it or not, you're not going to be able to compete with other teams. You may say, a perfect example is the Marvin Jones deal for the Lions. A lot of people say, and you'll read it, oh, the money was the same. Yeah. They offered him the same thing. He got $20 million guaranteed from the Lions. Bengals...
Well, Joe, wouldn't you say that Bengals players, so outsiders I can understand if they don't understand the way the Bengals operate, but Bengals players know that unless, and this is a good little segue to Adam Jones, which we'll talk about at the end. But yeah. In general, they know that when you sign a contract with the Bengals, it's just about as good as guaranteed. I think the problem with the Bengals and guaranteed money is they're not afraid of cap hits so much as they're afraid of actually spending money because right. Mike Brown has so little money. But in general, they honor their contracts. I mean, amazingly, Malaluga was such an unnecessary player towards the end of his career. And he just stuck on it until the very end. The last year, I think, in his contract, right? He had what did he have, like 700,000 guaranteed? It was very little.
Yeah. Same with Domantas Peko, things that.
Right. And so those guys knew, like any other team, like would have let them go probably a year or two earlier.
Yes.
I
was just going to say the Bengals have to do that because.
Well, but I'm saying, so someone like Marvin Jones, who was on the team and knows how they operate, do you really think, because he does seem like a guy of principle. He does seem like a guy.
Oh, he sounds like a good guy.
Yeah, a good guy. And so when he says that I wanted the opportunity to be a number one option, look at, he shined. I mean, he was pretty good. And I always thought he was great. I always wanted him. He was the one guy since Jonathan Joseph that I was really upset that we lost.
Same.
But he has shown that, you know, he is basically a number one option. And who knows if he would have got that opportunity. With the way the other receivers around AJ Green have looked in recent years, and AJ Green's numbers have declined as a result of kind of the dysfunctional offense, maybe Marvin Jones would have been just...
Well, he didn't know Tyler Eifert was going to be out for the
next
few years.
That's true. Yeah, that 2015 season, yeah.
Right. Eifert's coming off that huge year. In your mind, you're like, I'm the number three. So even if he wasn't going to be a number one with the Lions, because really him and Golden Tate, 1A, 1B... you're not going to be the number three with the Lions. So for that scenario, I completely got it. I even said that before free agency came, I said, Marvin Jones is capped. His production is capped with the Bengals. He's never going to have an insane year unless somebody gets hurt. And, nobody wants that, obviously. So it's in his best interest to go in a few. Production is important to anybody. I don't want to play 20 years or 15, 10 years, whatever, and only have 800 yards receiving every year when I can go to a different team, make similar or more money, and, 1,200 yards. That's just going to look better down the line. I want to know that.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you want to build your stats as how you remember and all that, but it's funny you said his production capped with the Bengals. I'll never forget that Chargers game. The playoffs.
Yeah.
It was a disaster in every sense, except for Marvin Jones.
Except for him.
And there's something, I love AJ Green, there's just something, though, about Marvin Jones' personality where there's just certain players. And this is, you're going to disagree with me strongly. I know you know about AJ McCarron's mechanics, all the analytics, all that stuff. But there's something about certain personalities that I think are important for a franchise like the Bengals to help them kind of overcome the losing franchise has a certain kind of black cloud hanging over it.
You know what it is? It's competing and fighting for your job every moment of your life. And when you're a fifth round pick, AJ McCarron, Marvin Jones, you have that chip on your shoulder.
It's also their personalities. I think
the combination. Yeah,
Marvin Jones became a father, what was he, like when he was in college, he had a lot of challenges. But he kind of has this kind of personality where it's like, nothing is too much for him. And same with AJ McCarron. I mean, these are ridiculous examples. It's just these little things I know about them here and there. Like McCarron, he had, the jet ski accident, and he had like his face torn off when he was a kid, right?
That's why he's got that scar.
Yeah, there's just something about the adversity that they faced and overcame and had a good attitude about it. I know I'm getting way far away from data.
You're not, because it's a correct point, because I don't think the Bengals, we talked about this with Russell Bodine, he was handed his job, and that's your job. Now, I think Russell Bodine's a tough dude, and he, you know, I like that he fights on the offensive line. He's about the only guy that's really a fighter, but currently. But at the same time, if you're not competing for your job day in and day out, I think the complacency sets in. I think even for backups, that they're like, it doesn't matter how well I play or how well I prepare, this team is not going to play me because my salary is not more than Drake Kirkpatrick's, let's say, for example. So, you know, that guy's going to start, I'm in the backup, and that's how it is. And that's how you feel like the Bengals operate in a lot of ways. So I think, you know, when crunch time happens, these guys are a little more frail and a little fragile, and sometimes they break a little bit easier. But it's those guys that have the chip on their shoulder that seem to be unfazed by it because they've been competing their whole life. This is nothing for them. So I'm in agreement with you. I think the it factor is hard to quantify. But there is something there sometimes where, and you can go to any job in America, in the world, and everyone's different at their job, and everyone's different to in terms of their talent or how they understand it, or, you know, just think of the 10 closest guys you work with or people you work with at your job. And that's when you got an inspection or you got something big going on or you guys are slammed and you're getting rushed. There's still those couple of guys that are unfazed by it. And then there's those couple of guys that just break down and they're worse because of it, because of the pressure.
That's, I hate to say it, but you know how McCarron had a disastrous first three quarters in that Steelers playoff game?
Yeah.
That almost makes what he did at the end. And it wasn't like he was moving the team 80 yards. I mean, they had great field position. Those last, you know, they scored, what was it, 15 points in the fourth quarter when they were down by, or they scored 16. They were down by 15 and scored 16, something like that. And it was a lot of great field position, all sorts. I understand that. But he converted a lot of third and fourth downs, and then the 25-yard pass to Green. Let's even say that wasn't even perfectly on target. Fine.
Sure.
But the
still got to make it.
The fact that after having a disastrous first three quarters, 0 points, he had a couple of turnovers, and he was like the rain was getting to him. He said it after the game. And then, despite all that, he still makes the plays down the stretch. It almost says more than if he had a great game overall. Dalton, think about the games where he has a couple of turnovers. By the fourth quarter, he's just throwing it away on fourth and five. He's just like, I just want to get out of here.
Right? It's funny because, like, how many times can you say, oh, we got bad Andy today? And it's not going to change in the second half. You have bad Andy today. That's who it is for the rest of the game. Rarely. And
especially
sometimes he
in,
will.
In like primetime games. If he starts out,
Once in a while you get, you know, a flip-flop within a game, but usually that's it for him.
And when you have good Andy, he's still doing the get the ball out in 2 seconds. Right. He's still that Andy, where it's like
he's
everything's clicking. He's seeing
guard.
Everything.
He's still
perfect.
A facilitator of the offense rather than the design or the creator of the offense.
He's like seeing everything perfectly, and the plays that they're running are working, and you know his arsenal is healthy and all of that. It's like everything's clicking. Whereas with other players, it can be like, you know, they just kind of pull something out of their hat, you know. But anyways, we're
getting another example, though, for that in the comparison of the quarterbacks. Think of how bad Dalton has been in the playoffs. And think about how the first three quarters went in that one Texans game. Was it the first or the second Texans playoff game? And he had an opportunity to hit A.J. Green in that fourth quarter in the end zone. And he missed it. I mean, the whole game is forgotten about if you hit that throw. That's compounding a bad first, you know, three quarters, three and a half quarters, and letting it ride out and finish being a bad game instead of, to his point, to his credit, A.J. McCarron, it didn't affect him. He was the same guy for the whole game. And that, you know, whether that was he threw an interception or had a fumble, didn't matter. The next play, it didn't matter. And there is something to that. I think the best guys have that. Guys like Tom Brady. It doesn't. He missed throws all the time.
He does. And early in his career, that's the thing is people forget. He wasn't a prolific he wasn't like lighting it up in those playoffs. It's like he just made a few critical plays late in the game.
Yep.
He was throwing some ducks. He was throwing some wobbly passes.
I've seen a lot of people say about Andy Dalton, right? Because they'll say, well, he still had some upside. There's still some potential there. Look, Drew Brees took 5 years or 4 years. Ben Roethlisberger was in a run-first offense. Tom Brady was in. But the difference is in that right there. Those guys were the same guys. Yeah. They just weren't running the offense. And they needed time to fully turn into themselves.
Right.
The 60%, the 70%, 80% of themselves was there. You can see it there at the time. They just weren't the creator of the offense. They were in an offense designed for them to flow through it rather than built around them. And we've seen offenses built around Dalton. They really did it very early in his career just to maximize his talent. And they have done that. But at the same time, I'm not expecting Andy Dalton to turn into a different guy now in year eight. I think everyone agrees he is who he is at this point.
Well, let's just kind of go crazy here. So with the Browns solidifying their, you know, bridge QB position, let's say.
Yep. Tyrod Taylor.
They're out of contention for McCarron. Basically, right. It comes down to the Broncos, the Jets, the Cardinals, maybe the Bills. Depending on who loses out on Cousins, who loses out on, you know, Keenum, who wants to take a chance on Bradford, you know, all. I don't think Teddy Bridgewater is going to get a starting job unless it's in Minnesota, but.
Well, I don't think so either. I don't even think he'll go back to Minnesota if they get Cousins.
Yeah. No, not if they get a Cousins. I'm saying if Minnesota loses out on everybody, they might give Bridgewater, you know, take Bridgewater, or like give him a, I don't know, $8 million, $1, sure. You know, 1 year, $8 million deal, and then draft somebody or something. Anyways. So we're still sure he's not coming back to the Bengals, right? I mean, we're sure one of these teams is going to sign him to a starting contract, right?
I think we're going to hit on a similar point again. I don't think McCarron ever really had a chance to compete for the starting job. They liked him. They liked him as backup. I think they really valued him. That's why they didn't trade him for just a straight-up third-rounder or second-rounder from the Browns this past year, and they wanted both picks instead. So they valued A.J. McCarron. I just don't think he ever really had a chance to compete, and he knows that. If he's coming from the Bengals, he knows he's never going to get that opportunity to unseat Andy Dalton. Now, if they tell him otherwise and say, we're going to give you a fair shot here, we're going to give you $6 million, $8 million as the backup, and you're really going to have a chance to play, maybe. But I think at the same time, you are getting that same option and guarantee from someone like the Cardinals or the Broncos or right. The Bills. So
because, I mean, no, if he signs before the draft, there's no guarantee that, like, if they sign him to a Mike Glennon deal, right, or even worse, like a Chase Daniel or, I don't know.
Sure.
Who's the guy? Nick Foles, something like that. You know, basically Eagles backup deal where it's like a pretty lucrative backup deal, but still a backup deal. If a team signs him to that, he's not going to feel very confident. You know, maybe he waits it out and sees what happens in the draft and maybe goes to the team.
I don't think he should be confident either way. Even though the Browns were rumored to have interest and really like him, they were still drafting a quarterback. So, for him, he may think he is a starter, but I don't think any team is viewing him as a long-term starter this free agency.
I think teams in general, like, you know, he's an unknown. I don't think anybody views him as a starter the way they view Jimmy Garoppolo as a starter. But right. I think they might view him the way Jimmy Garoppolo was viewed before he was traded to the 49ers, let's say, where it's like he showed some flashes. Depends on how desperate the franchise is, which is why I really thought the Browns would take him, because I think Hugh Jackson's so desperate to get production from his quarterback right now. And I think Tyrod's good. I don't think there's necessarily, I don't know who's better, Tyrod or McCarron, but.
But shows you, I think, that someone brought this up on Twitter, that Hugh Jackson's not running the show there now.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously the Browns are operating a little differently right now. And, you know, if it was Jackson calling the shots, McCarron's their guy.
Exactly. Because, I mean, because he knows, it's not even, you know, I think it's just Hugh Jackson's desperate to get something done, to be productive on the field now.
For sure. Yeah, yeah. This is his last chance. If he doesn't win here, he's never going to be head Cincinnati. Coach again.
Well, I don't know, maybe Lazor. Maybe
you're right, because you're right. You have the Bengals still.
He has the Bengals as head coach, yeah.
Right. That's what I mean, as head coach.
Yeah, yeah. But, so, Adam Jones. That's another move where I'm a little surprised.
You shouldn't be, though, right?
Yeah, you shouldn't be, because
it's this team?
What is he, 34? I mean, even from a football perspective, forget the, because I don't think the Bengals, I don't think his off-the-field stuff, they're so forgiving.
Like it's never fazed them.
Yeah, when they feel like they know a guy, then the off-field stuff doesn't bother them. Like, they're one of those guys that's like, you know, looks into a guy, you know, like, you know, in Curb Your Enthusiasm, look into his eyes and kind of like see if you can judge whether he's being truthful or not. And if they believe, you know, they believe a guy, that's it. You know, they're very old school, kind of loyal.
Yep. So the videos come out and they still defend him, you know?
Yeah. I think it's more about William Jackson III than it is about.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. And what's his name? You know, Adam Jones is what, 34 now? I don't know.
Yeah, in that range.
He's around 34, which is old for a cornerback. I mean, you know, he still has a lot of. He still has a lot of pep, or whatever you call it, on his punt returns. I mean, he still looks pretty athletic on those. But in terms of being an every down corner, like, how many guys have done that? There's, you know, Terrence Newman looks pretty good at that age. Who's that guy
They're few and far between.
Who's that guy in Washington, like, long time
ago? Darryl Green.
Darryl Green. Yeah, there's been a few.
Charles Woodson, maybe he ended up moving to safety, and Rod
but you
Woodson
give,
too.
But you give
those
10,
are Hall of Fame guys.
Yeah. But you give $10 million to Dre, who they're not, unfortunately, they're not going to move on from anytime soon.
Not at all.
You're going to have to pay William Jackson, and you're going to have to pay Darquez Dennard, in my opinion. I mean, he's your third corner.
Can you pay all three? I mean, right now, they're like, I think number two or three for highest cornerback depth chart in terms of salary allotted to them. Yeah. And that's, they were number one clearly before waving Pac-Man or not picking up his option. They're up there right now. And if Darquez Dennard has another solid year, I don't think he's going to get much more than what he's at 8.5 right now for his fifth year option.
Yeah.
So it should end up in that range, right. I think, as a nickel corner. But still, if you end up paying Kirkpatrick 10, Dennard 8.5, Wayne Jackson,
you got
his fifth year option.
You got to bribe a team like the Browns to take Dre's contract. You get like the way the Texans did with
Brock. He didn't get a lot of guarantees either. If you look after June 1st this year, they can actually start saving money on it. So I think a normal team would entertain that, especially if there's a corner there they like at 21. I think a normal team would consider that. But we talked about this with the Bengals and effectively guaranteeing their entire life of their contracts. That's how they interest people. Trading him or cutting a guy after 1 or 2 years of an extension,
it's unheard of.
Shows your money is, you know, what we're saying is guaranteed isn't actually guaranteed. So
they lose a lot of faith.
It's one thing to write in a contract that $30 million is guaranteed. It's another thing to say you'll get all $30 million over 5 years, because anything can happen. You can die in a car crash. That $30 million is not guaranteed anymore. You know, saying guarantee on a box versus actually guaranteeing it.
Or just even injury. The Bengals aren't going to pay, you know, even Dre. They're not going to pay him $10 million if he just absolutely can't play. I mean,
right, exactly.
But
you're only guaranteed so far.
Yeah, that's a good point. And then also they gotta keep space because they are set on bringing back Dunlap and Geno Atkins. And I don't have a problem with it because I'm kind of resigned to the fact that the Bengals are not ever going to win anything important. So I like having, you know, legendary players. You know, I like the fact that I like that Dunlap and Atkins have the opportunity to retire with the Bengals, even though they're probably not going to be good by the end of their contracts. At least not. I don't know. But I mean, I imagine Atkins, because of the kind of player he is, you know, he relies so much on strength. He reminds me of John Randall from the Vikings.
Right. He should still be good.
He should still be good. Dunlap, I mean, you know, maybe with the kind of the things he adds in terms of like deflecting passes and all that.
Right.
I don't know how effective
he's gotten so much better in run defense, and they haven't really reduced his snaps as much as they probably should.
That's true.
You know,
he's
they
only
can
29.
Keep him fresh longer.
I think he's only 29, right? Yeah.
And the thing about those two guys too, they probably have the best two contracts on the team. And you know, in terms of what their value is for an edge rusher, Dunlap is severely underpaid.
Yeah.
Atkins, if he ever hit the open market when that last deal was signed, he would have got Aaron Donald type money, crazy stupid money, $60 million guaranteed. So these guys have great deals. If the Bengals want to take care of them again for the final contract, I understand that too.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I was going to say, neither guy really are. I'd have to look. I don't look at either what they're making this year in terms of cap hits. But those guys are actually going to have to increase. Like someone said, well, you got to re-sign Dennard. And that goes to my point I just made. Yeah, but his cap number isn't really going to go up unless you front load it. Guys like Atkins, his number will probably go up a little bit. Dunlap probably go up significantly if you're giving them fair market value. So those guys you actually have to set money aside for. But a lot of times guys in that fifth year option or late in their contracts as veterans, you're not allocating that much more money. Like a guy like a Tyler Eifert, if you wanted to sign him, he's not going to get probably more than what his fifth year option is right now. So you actually, you know, save money by extending him last year, or now at this point you're not allocating any more money to extend a guy like that. You have already said we're paying this percentage of our cap to a guy like Eifert. So you know, in those situations, you're not investing more money. The Bengals try to make it sound like because they have to extend guys, they can't spend this extra money. But a lot of times in reality, they're never spending to the cap as it is.
Yeah, that's true. It's nice to have someone who understands the Bengals Bengals so well. Because, sometimes people get a little bit carried away. Yeah, but this Glenn trade kind of got me carried away a little bit too.
It's exciting.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, if you were saying, And it's the thing, we've set our standards differently to root for the Bengals or analyze the Bengals, you know, whatever your role is. But as you would a different, you do it differently than you would for a good franchise or a team that's aggressive, you know, actively trying to win, like the Eagles were the last 2 years, the Patriots continue to be. And people say, well, you can't compare them to those teams. Well, why not? Let's do it. Why not aim for the top and let's see where your team falls. And for the Bengals, making a move to go solidify a weak position, a position you said we screwed up twice. Not only did we screw up drafting Cedric Ogbuehi, we screwed up letting Injuworth walk, basically, you know, haggling over an extra year on a deal and a couple million dollars difference. We allowed that position to be a void and ruin an offense, really, in an entire year. So what did they do? They went out and solidified it. They weren't saying, you know, this we'll draft a guy at 12, you know, whatever the best tackle is. No, what they did is they went and got potentially a top 10 left tackle. They traded assets without really trading a pick. You know, they still have that first round pick. So I like it. It's a smart move on money. It's a smart move on draft capital. And it's a smart move in terms of need and potentially filling a hole and upgrading at that spot. So this is a move other franchises make, the top franchises make. This is something that, you know, those guys would say is, oh, good deal, but and, you know, good acquisition for the Bengals. For us, we're like, this is crazy. Who is this team? Who's making these decisions? So it's just, you know, it's interesting to see how different fans view their team's moves.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's, you know, Marvin Lewis coming to the Bengals was a great blessing. And then every time he threatens to leave, it seems like the team takes a big step forward. So, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe that's the key, is just have Marvin Lewis.
Imagine working at your job and just being okay. But every time you went into the boss's office, you got whatever you wanted.
Well, you got whatever you wanted, but you improved the company too. I mean, he's...
Right, that's, yeah, what if you walked in there and be like, no, you guys made more money. You guys, you know, we upped our sales. Our stock's never been higher. And the owner's like, yeah, but you're not really that good. I think anyone could have probably done this or at least done most of this. And you go, well, then I'm walking. And he goes, you know, all right, take whatever you need.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we'll see.
I like to compare the Bengals to average jobs.
Yeah. But anyways, Joe, I really appreciate you coming on. You guys can check Joe out on Twitter, which you should definitely do. Follow his articles on The Athletic. We'll probably have him back on in draft season if he has the time.
Don't tweet at me until I have my coffee.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
okay.
Well, I mean, you've definitely had your coffee by the time I want to tweet at you. Someone.
Yeah, you're on the West Coast.
Yeah. But yeah,
enjoying the sun and the nice weather while it's snowing today.
Yeah, it's not bad. But you can follow Bengals Wire on Twitter as well. You can follow me on Twitter, Cameron Zargar, and make sure to check out our site, bengalswire.usatoday.com. And we'll see you next time.